Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Susan Lynn, Associate Director of the Media Center of the Judge Baker Children's Center, an instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood, and The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. She'll speak on the topic, Why Play is Essential to Body, Mind, and Spirit. Dr. Lynn is a co-founder of the National Coalition Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. In 2000, she was appointed to the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Advertising to Children. Dr. Lynn's remarks were given as the second of two keynote addresses at a conference entitled Radical Amazement, The Spirituality of Childhood, organized by the Center for Faith Studies and hosted by Omaha's Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, April 3, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Deb McAllister, co-chairman of Radical Amazement.
And now I am so delighted to introduce Dr. Susan Lynn. As you can tell from the program, Susan's credentials and experiences are significant, but her stories of individual children and their journeys through childhood reflect her warmth and her caring, even as they respect encourage our respect for play. I think our concern for children's place in our competitive society has led us to devalue the role of play, to trivialize it, to view it as a component of early childhood, and then it's something that we outgrow. And I'm just going to read you one short quote from Susan's most recent book. The ability to play is central to our capacity to take risks, to experiment, to think critically, to act rather than react, to differentiate ourselves from our environment, and to make life meaningful. Parents can recognize the fundamental importance of pretend play. We can provide opportunities for our children to play. We can allow them to play alone. We can play with them. And we can let them generate the themes and stories they play about. Join me in welcoming Dr. Susan Lynn as we consider the case for make-believe.
Well, thanks so much to Deb and to Cindy and to Countryside for thinking of me at this wonderful conference on radical amazement. It's just one of my favorite things to think about, and I write about it a little bit in The Case for Make-Believe, the idea that, yes, we should be amazed that there's a dogwood tree blooming outside our window, but we should also be amazed at the fact that we have the capacity for amazement, that's part of being human, is the capacity for wonder. And so I'd like to tell two brief stories that are, one is about wonder and one is about innocence, and I think we need to differentiate those two. So when Cassidy was 2 years old, little girl, she burst into the living room where her parents were seated, completely naked, and she threw open her arms and she said, "I escaped my clothes." And when her father, laughing, told me that story, I laughed, but I also suddenly felt the confines of my clothing in a way that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And I could feel the rub of my pants on my knees. I could feel the shoes constraining my feet, the elastic band, I'm of that age, around my waist. And I had these memories of being without clothes, the feeling of a breeze over my body, and the feeling of being, you know, of being part of nature, and felt a sense of wonder about my body and the miracle of it and the miracle of being out, you know, in the world in a way that, you know, usually I don't think about every day. And And for me, Cassidy's incredible joy at her clothes and the notion of escaping them was just so embodied a child's sense of wonder. And, you know, and the way that they don't take anything for granted. You know, we take it for granted. I mean, dressing and undressing, you know, except in certain situations, is incredibly mundane. It's not something we think about. But for her, it was, an incredible triumph. And as Cassidy grows, she's going to be socialized. She's going to learn that she can't rip off her clothes everywhere that she wants. There might be struggles, you know, around that. But it is still possible if she is allowed to initiate activities on her own, if she is allowed to engage playfully, interactively with the world, it is still possible for her to become an adult hanging on to that sense of wonder. It was Einstein's sense of wonder that a compass always pointed north, his sense of childhood wonder, a thing that the rest of us just take for granted. It was that sense of wonder that led him to think about magnetic fields. And, I mean, scientific discoveries, as was said earlier, come about because of that sense of wonder and that sense of playfulness. The story of Sir Isaac Newton being bopped on the head with an apple is apocryphal, I guess, but it does, you know, show us what happens when we have people in the world who don't take everything for granted, who see things in a way that other people don't quite see them in the same way. The difference between a great artist and a competent draftsperson is not technique. It's that artist's capacity to see the world in a particular way, to interact with it, and to communicate that to the people around him. And that is rooted in creative play. The other story that I want to tell you is about innocence. And my husband and I, there's a little amusement park about an hour from my house that I just really love. It's called Canobie Lake Park, and it's a place we started taking my daughter once a year when she was three. We used to take her at night when it was really hot and she'd fall asleep in the car, and it's this great place for families, and it's one of the less commercial. It's not like Six Flags or Disneyland or anything like that. It's just a really nice family-owned place in a park. It's really quite wonderful. And so we were so delighted when we started having grandchildren and we could take our grandchildren, share that experience. And so we took the oldest, when she was three, to Canobie Lake Park. And she loved it just as my daughter did. And so we took her on the little, you know, toddler rides. And she went on a ride that was an airplane with a gun attached to it. And so we put her on, and then I noticed the guns, and I kind of went, you know, but there she was on this little ride, and all the kids were shooting each other and everything, the older kids, and she spent the whole time with her eye down at the base of the gun. It was this long gun with her eye down. So I came down and I said, "Gee, Marley, I was wondering what you were doing while you were in the ride," and she said, "I was taking pictures." She thought the gun was a camera, you know, and I thought, you know, here's a child who, you know, hasn't been raised, you know, she's fortunate. She hasn't been raised with violence. Her parents, you know, aren't fanatic about television, but she hadn't seen guns. She hadn't seen violence on television. And so she was innocent of them. And I knew that by the time she was four or five, we would take her back to Canobie Lake, and she would know that that was a gun. And that got me thinking that we can't expect that children will hang on to their innocence. And in fact, we don't want them ultimately to hang on to their innocence. We don't want adults to be innocent. It's important not to be innocent so that you can engage in the world and you can make informed decisions and maybe work to change the world. That's really important. But it is possible, and it's so important for us to help children hang on to their sense of wonder, to nurture that. And certainly being out in nature is an important, critical piece of that. But so is, and so is, creative play. And we have reached a time in our society where nurturing creative play has actually become countercultural. Now think about that. When you were growing up, you could assume, your parents just assumed that you were playing. When children, even when there wasn't, when there weren't child labor laws, even there, when there were kids in factories, there was an assumption that when kids had any leisure time, that they were playing. And for the first time in history, we cannot make that assumption. And in large part, that's because creative play, this is going to sound strange, but creative play is actually a threat to corporate profits. I know that sounds really strange. We live in a market-dominated society. We live in a consumer-based society. The notion of consumption is sold to us as a patriotic duty. We were told to go out and shop after September 11th when the Bush administration was getting ready to invade Iraq. Andrew Card was asked, why didn't you do it in, why didn't you start this, you know, preparing people in August? And his response was, you can't sell a new product in August. It has to, we equate wars and products. We run everything as though the market was going to work. Market is supposed to work for everything, you know, and we can see we're dealing with what that means. And so we are a consumer-based society. Consumption is essential. And children who play creatively need less of the things that corporations sell to them. A child who plays creatively can pick up a stick and transform it into Harry Potter's wand. The child doesn't need Harry Potter's wand. A child who's creative can pick up a block and transform it into tons and tons of things. But the toys that are sold to children, the toys that are marketed to children on a daily basis, the toys that parents are led to believe that their children need in order to be happy and in order to play, those are largely the toys that prevent rather than nurture creative play. When it comes to profits, creative play is a bust. And so we live in a society where we are actually depriving children of the time, space, and silence essential for creative play. Now, it's not just the commercial world. I'm the director of a national coalition called the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. And we look on advertising and marketing as an issue of rights and freedoms. The rights of children to grow up and the freedom for parents to raise them without being undermined by commercial interests, without being undermined by greed. And so we take on companies about their advertising policies, and we've actually had some surprising successes, which I will talk to you about, you know, sort of as we go along. Now advertising and marketing, commercialism isn't the only threat to children's play. You know, Rich talked last night about, you know, the importance of connecting children with nature, that children play more creatively in green space. The fact that schools have cut recess is very troubling. The fact that academics have been pushed down into preschool and kindergarten, and that the report that the Alliance for Childhood just put out, what it shows is that play has been drummed out of kindergarten largely. The kind of play that we remember, block play, water play, dress-up play, has been drummed out of kindergarten. And yet play is the foundation of learning, of critical thinking, of creativity, of problem-solving. It's how children learn how to learn. It's how they learn self-regulation. You know, the capacity for self-control, and also the capacity to see something or to envision an idea and be able to work to get to that idea. That comes about through unstructured, hands-on creative play. So all of that is true. It is not, and the fact that kids are overscheduled, all of that. But I really do believe that of all of those issues, that the unprecedented convergence of sophisticated, ubiquitous, miniaturized screen media and unfettered commercialism is a disaster for children, and it is particularly a disaster for children's creative play. And it's not that I'm anti-media. I'm not. I came of age at a time when there was a lot of hope for television. I worked with Fred Rogers, and I certainly believe that television has the potential, and movies have the potential, to be positive in children's lives. But the fact is that these days there are too many screens selling too many things in the lives of too many children, and we need to find ways to set limits. I see this as a socio-political issue. I don't think it can be just up to families. The marketing industry would have you believe that families can just say no, but I think this is a societal issue, and that we do need to set limits on corporate America and the ways that they target children. And you know, particularly today, and what's dearest to my heart is around the issues of how marketing has an impact on creative play. A good toy is 90% child and 10% toy. But most of the toys that are sold to children are 90% toy and 10% child, or even 100% toy. So, and that happens in two ways. One of the ways is all of these toys embedded with computer chips that talk and chirp and beep and sing and dance and do backflips all by themselves. And so all a child has to do is press a button. And those are the toys that we're even giving infants, so that all infants have to do is press a button. The toys that are 90% child, blocks, stuffed animals without computer chips, dolls, water, sand, seems so old-fashioned to people. Really, we have to be modern. We've got to get kids into technology from birth. But in fact, what those toys do is distract children. They fill their lives with noise and creativity. Creative play thrives on silence. They distract children with noise. And also, they teach kids that all they have to do is press a button. So I've had kids come into my office and look at a stuffed animal and say, "What does it do?" I was doing my puppet Audrey Duck with a four-year-old just the other day who said to me, "Well, do you have to turn her off?" The idea that I was making her talk. I mean, that wasn't... no child had ever said that to me before. Children have wondered how my puppets talk, but nobody ever really thought that she was a machine. And so we have to ask ourselves today, when we think about screen media and when we think about public television even, is can a media program really be good for children if it supports itself by marketing toys that undermine rather than promote creative play? And I'll take Sesame Street as an example of that. It's Sesame Street's 40th birthday this week. Sesame Street is a national icon. Certainly they have done some great things for kids. They did diversity better than anybody else, I think. And yet, every year, for the past several years, Sesame workshop has put out a Tickle Me Elmo toy. And what, you know, started out, you pushed a button and Elmo laughed. And so it, that those kinds of toys, those electronic toys, sell so well on television because you only see the toy for 10, 15 seconds, and it fulfills every child's wish. It looks like, don't we wish that our toys would come to life, don't we? That's what we wished when we were children. Our dolls would really come to life. So it looks like Elmo or these talking dolls, Amazing Amanda, for instance, that they're coming to life, but they're not. They just do a thing, and you don't have to really do much of anything. And so what happens with that is that you get this toy, and it's your heart's desire because you've been told it's supposed to be your heart's desire. And then after a few hours, a few days, a month, you get tired of pressing the button. But because children believe that play resides in the objects they play with, not within themselves, they believe that what they need is the next toy. So every year, Sesame Workshop comes out with a new Tickle Me Elmo. So the next holiday season, you get YMC Elmo, YMCA Elmo, or you get Chicken Dance Elmo. You get an Elmo that does one other different thing. Now you can get an Elmo that's, you know, that's hooked up to the web and things like that. And so we have to think about the fact that we are training children to depend on technology, in particular screen technology, for all of their stimulation and their soothing, and we're depriving them, starting from infancy, of the opportunities to do that themselves. So that's one way that this conversion of technology and unfettered commercialism is really strangling children's capacity for creative play. The other way has to do with the fact that most of the toys that are sold to children today are based on media characters and come from the media. Children play less creatively with media-linked toys. Now, when I was writing the case for Make Believe, I really struggled with this issue, really for months, because, in fact, television had a profound and positive impact on me when I was a child. I became a ventriloquist because of television. I did not grow up in a family of ventriloquists. I saw a ventriloquist on television. It sparked my imagination. You know, we went to the library. My parents got me out a book, and that was my life's work came from television. And the other thing was that my fantasy play, hours and hours of indoor and outdoor fantasy play, was all wrapped up in two media characters, Walt Disney's Peter Pan and a character that I saw on television called Flash Gordon, who was like the first superhero. And in my world, Flash Gordon and Peter Pan knew each other. They knew me. Ming the Merciless and Captain Hook were buddies. We campaigned for, you know, whatever. I mean, I really... years. I mean, I spent playing Peter Pan and Flash Gordon. So I thought to myself, well, how can I complain about children's media use? How can I complain about media-linked toys? And I have this vivid memory of a cardboard punch-out of Captain Hook's ship. I mean, a vivid memory of the pleasure I took in putting that together. So here I am. You know, who am I to say that it's bad for kids? And I thought about it a lot. And then I realized that there really is a difference. And the difference is, one of the differences is access. I saw Walt Disney's Peter Pan in a movie theater once. I saw it once. And then I saw Flash Gordon on television maybe once a year. So if I wanted to evoke those feelings, if I wanted to evoke and what it really felt like, whatever it was about those two characters and their worlds that grabbed me, I had to play about it. But these days, kids don't have to play about it. If they want to evoke any Disney movie, all they have to do is they own the video. They see it in the back seat of their parents' cars. They see it on MP3 players. They can see it on on cell phones. They can see it over and over and over and over and over again. And then all their toys. I had one Peter Pan toy, right? But all of their toys are Disney princess toys. And so what happens is the children get locked in these set scripts. They get locked in these scripts, and they play them over and over and over and over again. So for instance, I was playing with a four-year-old girl who was completely immersed in the Disney princesses. And I also believe that if kids are immersed in media, I don't think that they should be. But if they are, and they want to play about it, we have to let them play about it. What we have to try to do is move their play a little bit, you know? Instead of playing Spider-Man, can you make a cave for Spider-Man? Can you make lunch for Spider-Man? Can you draw your own Pokemon cards? You know, something, you know, like that. If you have kids in your classrooms or who are, you know, that's all they want to do, find ways to broaden it. So at least they bring something creative and it has some meaning for them. So this little girl, she said, she always wanted to play princesses. So we play princesses. So I spilled something and I was scrubbing it up and I said, I feel like Cinderella. Well, that's a tactical error, because if you're playing Cinderella with a little girl, you don't get to be Cinderella. She gets to be Cinderella. I was wrong. So she was righteously and rightfully indignant. She said, you're not Cinderella. And I said, well, who am I? And she said, you're Anastasia. Well, you know who Anastasia is? She's a tall, skinny stepsister in Cinderella. And I said, Anastasia never scrubbed a floor in her life. And she said, she does in Cinderella 3. I said, there's a Cinderella 3? And she said, yes, she said, after Cinderella gets married. So it's not even just that they're seeing Cinderella over and over and over again. And we're not, I don't have time to go into the sexism and the racism in the Disney movies. I'm not even going there in this talk. But it's not just Cinderella. It's Cinderella 1, 2, and 3, and the fact that all the princes are brand. It is just endless. And for little girls, they're programmed into these highly sexualized dolls, you know, that they go from Cinderella to the Bratz and so on. And for, you know, for boys, of course, it's violent. Of all of the commercial threats to creative play, the one that troubles me the most is the media and marketing industry's relentless assault on babies and toddlers. They want to get kids really from the moment that they are born. And the industry does talk about that. They talk about cradle-to-grave brand loyalty. The owner of Kids R Us, which doesn't, I guess, exist anymore, said, if you can own a child by two, you can own that child for life. They want the kids to buy things and to spend their allowance money and things like that. They want that. But they want the kids when the kids grow up. And that's why, at this point with Disney, you can bring your little girl home to a Disney princess bedroom. You can take her to Disney World when you get older. You can, you know, just fill her room with all the Disney princess stuff, and now there's the Tinkerbell stuff. You can do all of that. And then she can get into High School Musical, and then she can get married in a Disney princess wedding gown. Disney's making wedding gowns now. You can have your honeymoon at Disney World, and then you can have your first child, and it can start all over again. So cradle to grave, you know, brand loyalty. And it starts with babies. And it is really hard to find things for babies. It's so hard to find things for babies that aren't plastered with characters. Even the diapers. It's hard to find a diaper without a character right at the most important part of the diaper. And I, at the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, I work with a young man named Josh Golan who just had his first baby. And I had to laugh. He was on the phone with Huggies, because I guess the Huggies diapers were really absorbent. And he was on the phone with Huggies saying, do you have any Huggies diapers that don't have media characters on them? And the woman said, well, why would you want a a diaper that didn't have a media character on it. But what happens, the reason that they have all these media characters is that the kids fall in love with them. They fall in love with them. You know, one of the things about babies is that they thrive on familiarity. You know, I mean, babies start to smile at us when they begin to recognize our faces. They thrive on familiarity. And so what happens if a child is completely surrounded by Elmo, a baby, or completely surrounded by Winnie the Pooh, the baby will start to recognize the Winnie the Pooh, and then anytime the baby sees the Winnie the Pooh, the baby will smile, and their parents will think that there's something in that character that is incredibly special that will make a difference. And part of it, a large part of it, is the familiarity. So I have a colleague who lives out on Salt Spring Island off the coast of Vancouver. And he has a stone Buddha by his stairway. And there was a baby growing up on the island, and the family did not have televisions. The baby didn't know any of these media characters. And the baby came to visit him a lot. And the baby fell in love with the Buddha. It was the same. It was like Elmo. The Buddha was like the baby's Elmo. Every time the baby saw the Buddha, the baby would laugh and smile and things. And I thought, wow, those Buddhists could really make a lot of money, you know, if they started putting the Buddha on diapers. It's kind of against their philosophy. So we inundate babies with these characters, and then the characters become, they're not what the baby needs, but they become what the baby needs. They become what children need because we convince children that they are what they need. A baby growing up without Elmo or without Winnie the Pooh or without Dora the Explorer, that's not a deprived child. You know, they make their own. They create their own images. That's a child with the potential of an incredibly rich fantasy life. So, and then what happens with the characters, of course, is that they turn up on food. I took that from my local grocery store. And so you can see, you know, and the characters in and of themselves aren't a problem, but they are used to sell kids things. So we don't have characters in children's lives, commercial characters in children's lives, that aren't selling them something. And then the characters become everywhere. 40,000 Disney princess items on the market. The characters are everywhere, and then the children's play just becomes so constricted. And then, if any of you get the New Yorker, this is the cover of the New Yorker, and it's got all of these different ads for things like pills you can swallow to make you smarter and learn languages while you sleep and, you know, all of these products, all of these quick fixes for us. You know, everything's a quick fix and we can buy it. And that is the exact opposite of what's really important for children. There's not a quick fix for creative play. We don't want kids to think there's a quick fix for everything. We want them to be able to have the imagination and the stamina to be able to work things through, you know, to build, to gain patience. And that comes about through hands-on creative play, through building with blocks, through drawing, through doing something over and over and over again for the sheer pleasure of it, the sheer joy of it. And one of the big differences between people often say that play is the work of childhood. And I think that the reason that they do that is because they want to communicate how important it is to children. But I don't think that's really true, that play is the work of childhood. There's a difference between play and work. And the difference is that when we work, what's most important is the outcome. It's the product. It's the conclusion. We are working for something. The process doesn't matter so much. It's the conclusion. That's what matters. But play is, what's important in play is the process. The process of playing is satisfying in and of itself. That's what's important. And that's a real important difference. And it's important because creativity and creative play is an important part of work. Creative play is where the ideas begin. We play creatively when we're solving a problem, if we have the time to mull it over or think about it or take a shower, or in your mind you're going through all these different possibilities and you're letting your mind sort of flow around something, that's playing. That, you know, that's adult play around ideas. We play with words. We work because we have to get things done. But the joy of working, the most satisfying parts of people's work, I think, are when they are playing. And perhaps the thing that troubles me most about the targeting of babies is the whole baby video scam, the baby Einstein brainy baby. There's no evidence that babies learn anything from baby videos. And yet, by 2006, 20 million baby Einstein videos had been sold because parents have been marketed that these videos are educational for babies. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for children under the age of 2. One gift that we could give the children, you can give the children that you know, the children that you work with, the parents, is to really talk to them about the fact that it's a complete and utter scam. And in fact, there is some small evidence that it may be harmful. And certainly what it's doing, what the research show, is that the more babies watch television, the more they watch screens, the less time they spend engaged in creative play and in interacting with their parents, the two things which we know are educational. The Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood filed a Federal Trade Commission complaint against Disney for false and deceptive marketing. And we filed it in the last administration. At the time, we had an FTC that didn't want to regulate anything. But the FTC agreed with us. I went down and met with the commissioners. They agreed with us that there was a problem. And they put a lot of pressure on Disney. And so Disney has changed the way it markets Baby Einstein. They no longer say that it's educational. I can't find the word educational anywhere on the website. They still say strange things. Like they say, baby Neptune, the video Baby Neptune, will introduce your baby to water. So I think about all those dry, dirty babies who, you know, have to watch Baby Neptune in order to be introduced to water. But, you know, the whole purpose of these screens is to convince parents that they're providing something that parents really, you know, ordinarily, you know, can a good enough parent provides on his or her own. So I tell you that story, first of all, because I do hope that that's something you take away, and also because it shows that, you know, small nonprofits, underfunded people really can make a difference. And yes, we have to provide in our own families and our own classrooms and in our own churches and synagogues and mosques, we have to provide time and space and silence for children to play. We have to carve it out. It's not going to happen automatically. We have to make sanctuaries. We have to provide children sanctuaries from commercial culture and from electronic media. We don't have to ban it altogether, although it's not good for babies. But we do have to provide spaces, commercial-free, media-free time in children's lives where they learn to take their pleasure from interacting with the real world. That's why, you know, getting them out in nature is so important for their creativity, not just for stewardship of the earth. And I'm going to finish up with one story, and it's a short story, I promise. I want to go back to the little girl who loves Disney princesses. And what I said about we have to meet children where they are, she wanted to play about princesses, and I wasn't happy about that, but I felt like it was her play. We need to let children lead their play. And I write about that in the case for make-believe. So anyway, there we were playing, and she said, let's pretend that I'm a beautiful princess, and I'm drowning in the Red Sea, she said, and you're a handsome prince, and you have to rescue me. I thought that was really interesting, you know, the Red Sea part of it. And then I realized, well, she's Jewish. It was just after Passover. That's a pretty scary story, you know, the Red Sea and the Pharaoh's army drowning. And so, okay, so who wouldn't want to be rescued from that? But I didn't like the idea of a prince rescuing her, so I didn't know what to do. So she leaped into the Red Sea, and she started drowning. Help! 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 And I stood on the side of the Red Sea thinking, because I didn't know what I was going to do. She was going, help! 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 And I was thinking, and she said, help! Help! And she said, you're supposed to be rescuing me. And I said, arr. So she was going, help, help. And I said, oh, dear, I'm a handsome prince, and I'm on the side of the Red Sea, and the princess is drowning, and I'm supposed to rescue her, but I don't know how to swim. Oh, no, what am I going to do? She's going, help, help, help. And so I leaped in the water, and I started going, help, help, help. She was going, help, help, help. I was going, help, help. And I knew I could out-help her. You know, I was going, help, help, help. She went, help, help, help. And then she said, suddenly, I remember how to swim. And she rescued me. So you can make a difference when you play with children in their lives. And we have to make a difference on all those levels. We have to make a difference with policy. We have to make a difference in schools. We have to work to get play back in kindergarten. And we have to support parents so that they can have free time and allow their children to play. And when we play with children, we can make a difference. And since this is about play, I thought that I would like to bring out my puppet Audrey Duck, who is really my favorite kind of play. And here she is.
Susan, what are we doing here today? Oh, no.
What's the matter?
Are we talking about commercialism in the lives of children?
Well, no, not, well, kind of, Audrey, but
we're not talking about that exclusively?
No, we aren't.
Did you fix it already?
I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about creative play.
Creative play?
Mm-hmm.
What is creative play?
What is it? You are creative play. You're my creative play.
Aren't you my creative play?
No, that's a little kind of metaphysical for me, Audrey, but no, you are. Creative play is when we bring ourselves into the world and we act on that, what we bring out, and we change the world a little bit. We manipulate what's inside of us, bring it out, and it's an interaction. Play takes place in the interaction of what's outside of us and what's inside of us.
Am I outside you or inside you?
You're both. You're both. You're inside of me. And you are outside of me all at the same time. Play is a paradox.
A paradox?
Mm-hmm.
Two ducks?
No. And with that, we don't have a lot of time, and I want to take questions, so you have to go.
I don't want to. I know. Can't I take questions?
No, you cannot.
You don't love me.
Audrey, go back.
Bye-bye.
So do we have any questions or comments?
Hi, I wanted to know what you think about social media and its impact on children as coming in younger and younger and younger. Your thoughts about how that's going to impact children.
That's a very good question. There's a big push to get children online to social networking sites. Webkinz, BarbieGirl.com, Club Penguin, younger and younger and younger children, preschool children. And you know, I've played Webkinz, and I think that there are things on Webkinz that are fun. It's not creative. Nothing much that happens on those social networking sites is creative. And the message in all of those sites is about buying. The whole purpose of those sites is to train kids how to shop online. Because what you do on those sites is you play games and you earn points in order to buy things for your pet or buy things for your penguin or to buy things for, you know, Barbie Girl or, you know, or whatever it is. I really think that people seem to think there's a difference between computers and television, but it's all merging. You know, it's all merging, computers and television. It's really, we have to think about screens and we have to limit them. And I do believe that the longer we can postpone it for kids, the more chance that they have to, as I said earlier, learn to take their pleasure from their interaction with the world, from their creativity, from making meaning of the world instead of having somebody else's meaning sort of just bombarding them. So that, you know, that's my thought about social networking sites for really young kids. I think there's something to be gained for adolescents, for older kids. The other thing about the social networking sites is that they're sold to parents as being safe. Nick.com, Nickelodeon's is another one. They're sold to parents as being safe because they have blocked access to the internet. So on a lot of the sites, the kids can't really interact with other kids. They have prepackaged things they can say. And on Nicktown, or Nicktropolis, which is the Nickelodeon social networking site, someone looked at it really carefully and found that most of what is you can say is an ad for some Nickelodeon television show. So,
I'd just like you to clarify something you said last night. 44 hours a week are used by children, youth. What's the age there? A week for media?
Children under the age of 18 spend over 40 hours a week engaged in electronic media. Most of it is electronically based. 19% of babies under the age of one have a television in their bedroom. Significant numbers of babies under the age of one are regular, 40% of three-month-old babies, I think, are regular viewers of television. I think I got that one right. 26% of children, of preschool children, have a television set in their bedroom. And that's something you can do. You know, have a television set. You don't need five television sets. You don't need five. And the more you can keep media out of your children's room, the more that they can use their room as a sanctuary for dreaming or playing or, you know, being on their own. So, you know, if you're going to have media, if you're going to have, you know, computers, which, you know, we all are probably going to, keep it in a public place. Have a family television, a family commercial, that family computer. That's how you learn to negotiate, too.
I guess I have to admit I'm kind of proud. My kids have pretty much grown up a lot, mostly without media. I mean, I guess my oldest is 7, so I can't really say. But at any rate, like, a lot of just, a lot of their toys are like scarves that they use as a scarf or as a tablecloth or as a napkin or as the blanket for a pretend picnic, that kind of thing. And so I'm really proud of that, and I'm proud that they aren't exposed to a lot of, you know, the Disney characters and that kind of thing at home. But they are at the grocery store, and they are everywhere, and there's something about marketing that really draws them. My daughter, who's now 7, can read, and when my son, who's an infant, leaked through his diaper, she said, "Oh, Mommy, we should have bought Huggies." And I said, "Why Huggies?" And she said, "Well, it says right on the box that they're leak-proof," which I thought was interesting. But my concern is that when she's out with her friends, or even with adults, and last summer, an adult showed her a character that was on his car, and he said, "Well, you know what this is." And she looked at me, and she didn't recognize it. It was a cartoon character, and she didn't recognize it. And then she kind of felt kind of funny, and she felt like she wasn't as smart because she didn't recognize that character. And I explained, "Well, you know, she doesn't really watch TV." And then my daughter said, "We do sometimes, Mom," because she didn't want to seem too weird, you mm-hmm. know. So I don't know if you can...
Yeah, the question that you're asking, which is, I have these values. My values are different from the community's, and I'm worried that my child is going to be a social outcast. I mean, that comes up every single time that I speak, and I struggle with that question a lot. And so I have a couple of things to say about it. One of them is that you can't do this alone. And that's why I keep saying it's not a family problem, it's a societal issue. We need to deal with it as a society. And right now, you know, as I said, nurturing creative play is countercultural. So you need to find community. You need to find at least one other family or a couple other families that share your values so that your kids have some place to go where they're not where they don't have to feel left out or different, you know, or things like that. That's one thing. It's hard to do it alone. Try to find communities, you know, spiritual communities, social, ethical communities, cultural communities, someplace where commercialism isn't the most important thing. The idea of these family nature groups, I think that's so great. That would be a time where it wouldn't be so important. So that's one piece of it. And another piece of it is that when you think about it, families are similar and different on lots of different levels. Okay? So one thing you can talk with your kids about is the way your family is like other kids and the way that they're different. And when they talk about, you're talking about my son's going to be teased or my daughter's going to be teased, kids are teased about all sorts of things. You know, so if you have a child who has good social skills, you know, who enjoys being with people, who's fun to be with, maybe they'll get teased a little, but they'll also, you know, learn how to deal with it. And I think that the issue of social outcasts, that has more relevance for preteens and adolescents than it does for really little kids or for nursery school kids. And kids with good social skills actually learn how to adapt, you know, and they will play Spider-Man, you know, they'll learn about it through their peers. And then, you know, to be really honest, you know, and because, you know, we're at a conference on radical amazement, I think we need to think about the value of raising nonconformists in this world, you know, and raising people who are willing to think outside the box. And we live in a culture that really squelches that. But every family I know who thinks about these issues struggles with that on all sorts of levels. And you need to think about yourself. You need to think about how susceptible your child is to peer pressure, how you feel about that, and, you know, what you want to give in on, what you don't want to give in on. We have to be conscious about it now in a way that we really never, you know, had to be, because it's just so ubiquitous. Does that help you? It's a tough question. Yes.
We spoke about the peer pressure that children feel when it comes to media, but it's also true for parents. I have a daughter in sixth grade who recently had a friend spend the night, and when dad came to pick her up, he asked, "What did you guys do? Were you on the computer all night?" And she very plainly said, "They don't have a computer." And so she and her dad looked at me, and I felt myself turning red almost. And he asked her, "Well, what did you do?" And she said, "We played hide and seek, and we played board games, and we were outside." And it was kind of an awkward silence. And then he said, "Well, you can come here anytime." And I felt a relief, but I felt like, I think parents pressure each other. It's almost a contest, you know, which kid has more video games or the new Nintendo DS or the most Disney movies or, and I'm a relatively young parent, so my generation feels that quite a lot, I think.
I think the whole notion of competition between parents is something that the marketing industry, the toy industry, plays on and preys on. And this idea, especially that technology is going to make your young child smarter, it's the way to go, you're old-fashioned. I mean, there's huge amounts of pressure. And, you know, and you just have to keep, I think, remembering. And you know, I don't think that everybody should unplug and move to the woods. I mean, not everybody can. But I think you have to keep remembering that we pass our values on to our children through the stories we tell them and the toys we give them, and that our values are really the greatest gift that we can give our kids. And somebody just wrote a book about living without the screen, actually, interviewing families who don't have television. And what they find with their kids is that there may be bumps along the way, but then when the kids grow up, they look back on it, you know, and are actually grateful, you know, for that. So again, you have to find what works for you. You know, you have to look at your own, how much you value creativity. You know, can you engage your kids in creative play? You know, if you're going to make decisions that are countercultural, your child is going to run up against some kind of peer response, unless you're in some kind of alternative school. And then you just have to weigh it all and say, you know, is it worth it? Does it, you know, how important is this, you know, to me? What am I really trying to do? What, you know, what really matters? And one thing I think it's important to know is that our children will love us, you know? I mean, that we don't have to give in to all this stuff in order to gain their love. And I know this because I think I wrote the book Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. I finished it when my daughter was probably 15 or 16. And I mean, we had a television. We didn't have five televisions. She didn't watch television when she was a baby. She did watch some television. I once did tell her that I would never buy her any toy that was advertised on television. And I really probably never did. But she had grandparents who gave her Barbies. I mean, I wasn't one of the parents that threw out the Barbies when they came in. I mean, you know, so I tried, when my husband and I tried to find our way, but I wasn't the easiest parent. I was the parent who wouldn't let her go see Titanic when she was when she was 10 years old because I couldn't bear the thought that the Titanic was a real story and she would watch those people drowning and it would upset her. And then I couldn't bear the thought that Titanic was a real story and she would watch those people drowning and it wouldn't upset her, you know? So I postponed. All the other kids got to see Titanic. She didn't get to see Titanic until, you know, I held out for 16 months or something like that. But when my book Consuming Kids was published, I was in New York, and I called my office, and Josh Golan, my colleague, answered the phone. He said, "Susan," he said in this odd tone, "you got your first review on Amazon," and I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes, you need to look at it." And I said, "Well, is it bad?" He said, "No, but you really need to look at it." So I went to look at it, and it was a 5-star review, and the little headline was "Amazing Book." And it said, "I learned so much from this book. There's so much in it that I didn't know before. Okay, I'll cut the crap. I'm the author's daughter. I love you, Mommy." And that was the review that went around the world. And, you know, my daughter, you know, she loves me, even though I was the mother that, you know, she couldn't have. You know, she remembers a toy that I didn't get her and stuff. You know, but she's capable of that. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Susan Lynn, author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood, and The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. She spoke on the topic, Why Play is Essential to Body, Mind, and Spirit. Dr. Lynn's remarks were given as the second of two keynote addresses at a conference entitled Radical Amazement, The Spirituality of Childhood, organized by the Center for Faith Studies and hosted by Omaha's Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, April 3, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler of Countryside Community Church for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.